And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM. And like I promised before the break, we are interviewing Zafar Bengash. Zafar is an Islamic scholar, an author, and a community leader. He is also the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. You can find him online at Crescent International, other publications. Zafar, I'm very glad we were able to reach you in particular today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brandon.
Well, we talked about this issue, at least in the case of Lebanon, back in December, and many of the things that we were concerned about appear to have happened. We talked about the bias inherent in the Special Tribunal for Lebanon, as it's called, the International Tribunal, and how it could lead to instability in Lebanon's government. Thanks to Zafar, you heard it here first. I guess there's a couple issues here. We want to talk about the instability in Lebanon's government, how it's collapsed or how it's changed. But I guess the tribunal is a big part of that. So we can take some time and go over just some of the new things we've learned or we wanted to discuss about the tribunal and its instability. I understand there's still debate in Lebanon over the assassination and possible Israeli involvement. So have there been any developments in that field?
As far as the assassination of Rafiq Hariri, a former prime minister, his assassination occurred on February the 14th, 2005. And as I had mentioned during our last conversation, at that time, accusing fingers were pointed at Syria, and it was said that this is the work of a very professional intelligence agency, and the only agency that would do so and was capable of carrying out this kind of an operation was the Syrian intelligence agency. So under great pressure, Syrian forces were forced to move out of Lebanon. They had been there for more than 20 years in a peacekeeping role. In fact, more than 30 years, actually, in peacekeeping role to keep the various factions, warring factions, apart. So once the Syrian forces were withdrawn, this, incidentally, was a long-time objective of both the Americans as well as the Israelis, because they felt that as long as Syrian forces are in Lebanon, that Israel would not be able to achieve its geopolitical and strategic objectives in Lebanon. So once the Syrians were out of the way, then accusing fingers started to be pointed towards Hezbollah. Now, it's also interesting to note that at that time, immediately after Rafiq Hariri's assassination, there were a number of Lebanese military officers that were arrested, among them a general, who spent nearly 4 years in prison. They were accused of complicity in the murder, in the assassination, and yet 4 years later they were found to have not been involved. And so for 4 years, even when this Special Tribunal for Lebanon was established by the United Nations, under Chapter 7, which basically took all authority and power away from Lebanon and reposed it in the hands of the Special Tribunal established by the United Nations, which essentially means dictated to by the Americans or the Israelis from behind the scenes. And so this tribunal basically ignored all of the information that was provided by Hezbollah or Syria with respect to Israeli involvement, Israeli complicity, Israeli manipulation of the situation. In fact, last October, a few months ago, there was a conference of the International Telecommunications Organization, at which that international conference clearly stated that Israel's manipulation of Lebanon's telecommunications system is a matter of grave concern, not merely to the people of Lebanon, but also to the international community. And so in the tribunal, evidence was presented that some of the mobile phones that were used were somehow linked to members of Hezbollah. Now, Hezbollah had constantly pointed out that our entire telecommunication system is compromised by the Israelis, and so they can easily manipulate the logs and the cell phones, etc. Secondly, Hezbollah had said that they had presented evidence to the tribunal, which unfortunately the tribunal completely ignored. It didn't sort of even look into it. Now, when there is an investigation, the essential point is that no piece of evidence should be dismissed, that everything should be looked at. Then finally, there is clear evidence. In fact, one of the American commentators by the name of Franklin Lamb, in a commentary about a month ago, had written that the former U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, a person by the name of Jeffrey Feltman, had actually sent a message to his successor to tell her, it's a lady, a female ambassador now in Lebanon, to tell her that he is going to give her a very nice gift by way of implicating Hezbollah in the assassination of Rafiq Hariri. And he went so far as to say that as far as Lebanon is concerned, or its government is concerned, it has absolutely no say with respect to the process of the tribunal or what the how the tribunal should conduct itself. He said that Lebanon's involvement in this whole episode is only and only that it is the scene of the crime. Beyond that, it has absolutely no control. And Jeffrey Feltman was certain in his words, and this was quoted by Franklin Lamb, he said that he has said that now it is impossible for Hezbollah to not be implicated because we are the ones who control the entire process. So all of this information is available in the public domain, those who want to try to understand the situation. So as we had said last month, you know, the tribunal has now handed over its report to the prosecutor in the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and it is widely known that some members of Hezbollah would be implicated or indicted by the tribunal. Now, so far, this information has not been released, but I think Hezbollah is aware through its own sources that that is what this particular tribunal is doing. And before the tribunal's report was handed over to the prosecutor at The Hague, Hezbollah's members in the cabinet, in the Lebanese cabinet, had been calling for an emergency cabinet meeting, which the Lebanese former Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri, who happens to be the son of the assassinated Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, refused to abide by. And despite repeated requests that there should be an emergency cabinet meeting to discuss this issue because it's going to affect the future of Lebanon, the stability of Lebanon, the Prime Minister simply refuses to deal with it. Instead, what does he do? He flies to Washington, and on January the 12th, when he was meeting Barack Obama in the White House, the 11 cabinet members that belong to Hezbollah and one of its coalition partners, they resigned from the government.
Yes, I understand. Perhaps you can verify this, but essentially the prime minister basically went to becoming the ex-prime minister during the time that he was in a meeting with Obama.
Absolutely, because according to the agreement under which this unity government was formed in Lebanon, it stipulated that if 11 out of the 30 cabinet members resigned, then that government would automatically stand dissolved. So while he was meeting Barack Obama, news came that 11 cabinet members have resigned publicly. They announced it in a press conference. And so he was from the Prime Minister of Lebanon, he became the ex-Prime Minister of Lebanon. Now, it's interesting to note that instead of flying back to Lebanon to deal with the situation, he went to France. He spent 2 days over there conferring with the French government. Of course, he spent another couple of days or a day or so in Washington to get his instructions from the Americans. Then he went to France to drum up support for himself over there against Hezbollah. And then before returning to Lebanon, he went to Turkey to try to persuade the Turkish Prime Minister, Tayyip Erdogan, to try to mediate. Incidentally, yesterday, the Turkish foreign minister actually flew to Lebanon, and it's interesting to note that both sides have more faith and trust in the Turkish government than they have either in the U.S. government, the French, or the U.N. tribunal. So it is quite possible that the Turks might be able to work out some kind of a compromise to resolve the crisis in Lebanon.
Well, on that note, I know that there had been moves towards reaching a compromise prior to the collapse of the current government, because there had been, I guess, intra-Arab and intra-Lebanon discussions Saudi Arabia, Syria were looking to mediate between the various blocs, the opposition and the government, because, as you've mentioned, because of the unpopularity of the tribunal within Lebanon, they were looking to back off somewhat and see where people could agree, where the investigation could go, looking at some of the charges, reviewing some of the charges. That was an ongoing process. Didn't they send Hillary Clinton at that point?
Yes, of course. You are quite right, and I'm glad that you brought this up, because Syria and Saudi Arabia representatives were meeting, and they were about to reach some kind of an agreement. Now, Syria and Saudi Arabia are important in the Lebanese context because Syria is in some ways inclined towards Hezbollah, whereas Saudi Arabia is backing the March 14th faction, which belongs to which Saad Hariri belongs. So the two were on opposite sides, and yet they were about to reach a compromise, but then Hillary Clinton put her spanner into this. You see, she's issued a statement saying that we will not allow any interference with the tribunal, and that we would not allow any moving away from the tribunal's findings. In other words, she sent out a warning to the Saudis that if you try to reach a compromise on anything, that the U.S. would not support it, and that the Saudis themselves might be in trouble. Now, we can see this, that on the one hand, the Americans are openly manipulating the tribunal, the Israelis are openly manipulating the tribunal, but when an attempt is made to try to resolve the political crisis that is about to erupt in Lebanon through the efforts of the Syrians and the Saudis, then the Americans issue a warning and tell the Saudis to back off. So the Americans, in other words, do not want to see stability in Lebanon, because this fits into their larger scheme that they feel, and their Israeli allies, that if they can destabilize Lebanon and try to undermine Hezbollah, that then that would provide an opportunity for the Israelis to strike or attack Lebanon one more time, because the Israeli army is really, it was in the summer of 2006 when they attacked Lebanon, invaded it and bombed it and killed about 1,100 people. But they were also badly mauled by Hezbollah in the fighting that ensued. So the Israeli army wishes to wash that stigma of defeat, and so they want to attack Lebanon one more time. And I want to point out to you that in March of 2008, this is according to documents released by WikiLeaks, they said that the Americans met with then Lebanese defense minister, his name is Elias Murr, and in the two-hour meeting, the Lebanese defense minister told them that if Israel wanted to attack Lebanon to destroy Hezbollah, that the Lebanese army will not interfere, and that the Lebanese government would welcome Israeli invasion of Lebanon to eliminate Hezbollah. Can you imagine a cabinet minister, a defense minister at that, inviting another government's military to come and attack his own country to eliminate a very important political and social player in its own country?
So you're talking about playing on divisions within Lebanon in order to eliminate the faction that Israel and the United States disagree with.
That is correct, absolutely. Now, you see, we need to keep in mind that Hezbollah is not only a guerrilla force, but it is also a political player. It has, I believe, 12 or 14, I think 14 members in parliament, in the Lebanese parliament. And if there were, let's say, free and fair elections in Lebanon, I am absolutely certain that Hezbollah would win a clear and absolute majority in the Lebanese parliament. But the manner in which Lebanese political system is divided, like, you know, the entire political sort of map is already pre-assigned. So first of all, Lebanon is divided, sort of, you know, the number of seats in parliament are apportioned between Lebanon's Muslim and Christian populations equally. So the Muslims take 50% of the seats, or they are allocated 50% of the seats, and the Christians are allocated 50% of the seats. Now, the Christian population in Lebanon is less than 30%. So here you have a very strange situation whereby 30% of the population is allocated 50% of the seats. Now, the 50% of the seats that are allocated to the Muslims are divided into three different factions between the Shias, who incidentally in Lebanon, they constitute an absolute majority of the population in the country, and the Sunnis, who are then the next group, and the Druze. So these three groups are grouped together in one block of 50% seats. So no matter how much popularity Hezbollah may have in Lebanon, according to this arrangement, they can never win an absolute majority in Lebanese parliament. Although if there were, let's say, a free election with one man, one vote, no allocation of seats ahead of time, I'm absolutely certain, 100% certain, that Hezbollah would win hands down. In fact, they would probably get not just 50% of the vote, although, you know, the Shia population in Lebanon is something like 65%. I am absolutely certain that Hezbollah would win perhaps 75 to 80% of the seats in the Lebanese parliament.
Well, most impartial observers would agree that the political system in Lebanon is not exactly representative as it is, and it tends to be unstable or tend to break down. And when it's breaking down, it seems to require intervention, outside intervention, in order to keep the status quo going. I think you've described a consistent pattern of the U.S. involving itself, because first, in terms of the tribunal, it was making sure that it was part of it and that it would go in a certain direction. And then later on, when there was talk of compromise and cooperation within Lebanon and mediation from Syria, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and so on, this is when Hillary Clinton comes in and she says they're not going to support any solution that is at the expense of the UN, that is the tribunal involved with the U.S.
Exactly. What basically Hillary Clinton was saying was that the U.S. would not accept any proposal that brings stability to Lebanon or that gets in the way of the objectives that the U.S. and the Israelis have already laid down for Lebanon through this tribunal.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me, like, Mike Whitney asked this on Counterpunch. He said, why should we assume that Hillary Clinton is more concerned with finding the killer of Hariri than his own son, who's highly involved in this process?
Exactly, absolutely. I mean, this is the incredible thing, that they seem to have taken on this matter. Whereas, like, you know, if you want to compare this situation with, let's say, the situation in Pakistan, every month at least several dozen people are killed by U.S. drone attacks, and these are, the overwhelming majority are civilians. Men, women, and children are blown to pieces in Pakistan every month. And in fact, last year there were more than 100 drone attacks on Pakistan, and these drones are, of course, pilotless planes where these operators are sitting in the United States thousands of miles away, and for them, killing people is like a computer game. They see this on their video screens, and they press a button, and a missile is fired, and a dozen or so people are blown to pieces. And then they issue a statement, and they say, today we have killed so many extremists or you know, alleged, they don't say alleged extremists, but suspected extremists or suspected Taliban sympathizers. So they're not even sure that these people are actually either Taliban or extremists or whatever, only suspected of being Taliban or suspected of being extremists. Even if they were Taliban, it gives the U.S. no right and no authority to go and kill people thousands of miles away. I mean, these are war crimes. In fact, some UN officials have questioned these drone attacks and have called them illegal under international law and illegal under the rules of engagement in war, because just as, for instance, the U.S. insists that, for instance, the Canadian-born Omar Khizr was an enemy non-combatant and that's why he has to be put on trial, yet the U.S. is involved in doing exactly the same thing, because it is not fighting on a battlefield, it is sitting, we don't even know who is the one who is pressing the button in Virginia or Arkansas or wherever they are sitting, or in, you know, Colorado in some base, and they are killing people thousands of miles away, and those people have absolutely done nothing to the United States. So these are innocent people that are being blown to pieces.
Well, I guess it doesn't stop the United States from determining who the culprits are in Lebanon or who's involved.
Exactly. So you see the same situation, you know, existing in Lebanon. I think the point that really needs to be understood clearly is that both the U.S. and Israel want to destabilize Lebanon, and they want to box in Hezbollah. And in fact, you know, there is evidence, the American officials have said that if Lebanon refuses to hand over the people that have been indicted or that are indicted by this tribunal, then severe sanctions would be imposed on Lebanon, which, unlike Iran, would not be able to withstand these sanctions because the Lebanese people, by and large, are used to living a life of luxury and easygoing and so on. So then it is likely to lead to a civil war in Lebanon. And this is what the Americans want. So if, let's say, there is a civil war in Lebanon or that Hezbollah say, okay, we have had enough, now we're going to take over the government, if they were to do so, then that would be used as a pretext by the Israelis to invade Lebanon, because then they'll say, well, now we have a country that is ruled by a party that is opposed to Israel's existence, or that is opposed to Israel, and therefore we have the right to go and attack them and get rid of them in order to neutralize this threat to Israel. So this is the scenario that is being played up over there.
Yeah, it seems to be, number one, a favored tool of the United States and sometimes Israel to use sanctions. Once democracy happens, if a representative government emerges, as did the case in Hamas, in Palestine, that led to sanctioning, that led to condemnation, even by our own government in Canada. In terms of destabilization, government falling apart in Lebanon as a result of this tribunal and the other factors, we know it doesn't come as much of a surprise to Israel. I understand as far back as August, I think it was, the Israeli chief of staff said that the tribunal could blame Hezbollah for the assassination, which would then lead to instability in Lebanon. So, you know, it's not a big surprise. But I guess we're starting to look at the international scope, going from Pakistan back to Lebanon, talking about Israel, Palestine. And we should take a look at Tunisia before we go. That's a situation that is emerging very quickly. The news is coming out. It's hard to keep up, and it's not an area that's been focused on much before. Now, I mean, do you happen to know what's been precipitating this, I guess you could call this, change in government in Tunisia?
Yes, of course. You know, the strongman, the Tunisian strongman, was overthrown, and he had to flee the country within a matter of 4 weeks. I'll be very honest with you, it came as a big surprise to me as well. Although I've been keeping track of developments there, I know many of the political players in Tunisia, but I was personally surprised, and I was trying to dig out as to what really happened. Now, although they outwardly, the whole situation was triggered by an event that occurred in a town or a city in somewhere in the middle of Tunisia, where an unemployed university graduate, now there are incidentally about 250,000 university graduates in Tunisia, of whom 70% are unemployed.
70%?
70% are unemployed, yes. And so this poor university graduate who couldn't find a job, what he did was he took a cart and started to sell vegetables in the town. And, you know, on December 2017th, a policeman came and he said, you know, you don't have a permit to sell vegetables. So he not only took his vegetables away, but he also confiscated his cart. So this university graduate, he went to the city hall and he spoke to an official there. He said, before I started vending and selling vegetables, I had come here and I was told that no permit is required. So what is it that, you know, here is a policeman, he confiscates everything, he beats me up, and I've come here. And there was a female official over there. Instead of answering his question, she slapped him on the face.
Really?
Absolutely. This is how these events occurred. So she slapped him. And this poor guy was so frustrated by this, he said his livelihood is taken away from him. He's being humiliated everywhere. So what he did was, whatever change he had in his pocket, he went to a gas station. He filled a canister with gas and came out in front of City Hall, doused himself with gas, and set himself on fire. And he was killed. Of course, he died. This enraged the people so much, and this was in the town of a small town called Sidi Bouzid. Okay, this is right in the middle of Tunisia. And the people came out, you know, other university graduates, unemployed graduates, unemployed workers, they came, they started demonstrating. And of course, in typical fashion, with these dictatorships throughout the Middle East rule, the police were ordered to fire at the demonstrators. So, of course, they killed a few demonstrators. The next day, even more people came out. And then this just started to grow. And then these demonstrations ultimately arrived at the beginning of this month, beginning of January. They started to occur in Tunis as well the capital city. And the thing that really tipped the balance was that the former dictator, President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, who incidentally used to be a general before he became the president, he carried out a coup against the former president Habib Bourguiba back in 1987. And Ben Ali ordered the army chief, General Rashid Ammar, to order his soldiers to shoot at the protesters because the police force, although 180,000 strong, was unable to quell the riots and the demonstrations that were occurring. So the army chief, to his great credit, he refused. He said, I'm not going to use my soldiers to kill people. I will not do it. And so this occurred, this actually happened on January the 12th. Now, this naturally created turmoil inside the ruling establishment because they felt that if the army is not going to side with us, the police is unable to quell the demonstrations, then I think if we were to ask Ben Ali to leave the country, and obviously him and his family and his wife and her nephews and so on, they had plundered literally billions of dollars and stolen from the country. She had a favorite nephew who was the real, you know, kingmaker. He was basically entering into real estate deals, etc. So the establishment within Tunisia that included the prime minister, other cabinet ministers and security chiefs, intelligence chiefs, etc., they told Ben Ali that perhaps the best thing would be for him to leave the country, otherwise the situation could get out of hand. So Ben Ali also realized that he has already made his billions and he no longer needs to be in the country. Him and his family and some of his family members fled by car to Libya, and on Friday, January the 14th, when he tried, first he declared a state of emergency and imposed a curfew, but nobody could impose it because the army refused to impose it. So Ben Ali fled from there. He wanted to go to Paris. The French government realized that his time is up, so they refused to allow him to enter their country, although previously the French had and the Americans had supported him fully.
Yes, it's a familiar story almost from that point. You have the army refusing to fire.
Yes.
I think I just read in the newspaper today that his wife took a ton and a half of gold in savings.
Absolutely, yes. You know, it's incredible that she took a ton and a half of gold with her. She ended up in Abu Dhabi, incidentally. And you see, Abu Dhabi and Dubai are the gold markets of the Middle East because that's where you know, they have a free market. You can go and buy whatever you want. So she decided to take all that gold with her. And of course, you know, the Swiss government has announced and the banks that they are going to freeze Ben Ali's accounts. But I think we need to keep in mind that they do so only after the events. And it seems that perhaps they are now trying to win sympathies of the people that have come out into the streets because the people are still not satisfied with the way the situation is evolving in Tunisia. They have they refuse to accept the interim government because they say that it is still dominated by the old guard, people like, you know, Mohamed Ghannouchi, who is the prime minister, who's linked with Ben Ali for the last 20 years. The interim president Fouad Mabiza, who was the former parliamentary speaker, and many other cabinet ministers who are closely aligned with Ben Ali, that you know, the people are unhappy with that. So yesterday, actually, four cabinet ministers resigned, and they said that unless and until this situation is cleared up, we are not going to sit in the cabinet because it's still dominated too much by the old guard. Although both Mabiza and Ghannouchi announced that they were resigning from the ruling Dastourian party, but I think people know that you can declare that you are resigning from the party, but you are still carrying out the same policies.
Well, it's just interesting how slow the international community was to react on this issue, given that the United States tends to involve itself in the processes of government in Lebanon and elsewhere, that, as you've mentioned, there was a slow freezing of the accounts. There haven't been U.S. democracy promotion organizations all over the place setting up NGOs to overthrow this government. It's been happening because the people there seem to be upset. There seems to be a lot of simmering unrest. And it's just a process where they keep pushing and pushing. And the ex-president, the ex-dictator couldn't run things the way they wanted it, so they pushed him out, it looks like.
Exactly. You see, until Ben Ali fled the country, until that time, the statements that that Obama and other U.S. officials uttered were all to say, well, you know, we call for calm and we want, you know, people to be peaceful and not get violent and so on. Not a word against the brutality of the regime. But once the regime fled, then Obama said, well, you know, we welcome the people's aspirations and they should be given the right to participate freely in elections and so on.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how the U.S. works with whoever comes in next.
That's correct, yes. But I want to just also say that I'm afraid we shouldn't keep our hopes too high unless and until the old guard are completely removed from power. Otherwise, the old system will continue to operate.
And that's something we'll be able to look for and something we'll be able to follow up on. Well, I mean, today you brought context on things we had been missing out. Syrian withdrawal from Lebanon is a cause of instability in current events. It's not commented on enough. Hezbollah concerns about the telecommunications network. What you've done today has given us the work of three or maybe five reporters. I'm glad you still have your voice. I know you have so many responsibilities. So,
it's a pleasure. No problem.
We'll get this out there. I appreciate it so much. Again, this is very rich what you've given us today.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Safar.
You take care, Brandon.
You
Bye-bye.
Too. Bye-bye.